I'm Christopher Leiden of Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. And now for something entirely different. What follows is a conversation I had with the new president of the Rhode Island School of Design, John Maeda, on Wednesday, July 16th. For just under an hour, it was unrehearsed, unstructured, but full of interest, I think, and I hope it's the first of many conversations with John Maeda. Hope you enjoy it. Let us know at radioopensource.org. Can I just plunge and ask you, have you seen Wall-E?
Wall-E, no, I haven't. I want to. Is it good?
It's fascinating, and yeah. I want to know how a graphic artist looks at something like that.
Oh, probably uses his eyes. Or yeah.
I was fascinated by so many things. I mean, yeah. the transparency of a computer-generated animation now. Yeah. It's a completely human event. Yeah.
Well, it all goes back to the laws that Lasseter set down a long time ago. He wrote a famous paper on how actual character animation happens, because before Lasseter occurred, people didn't know how to do computer animation. It was all mathematicians, engineers making animation, but it didn't look really real. So Lasseter brought the Disney rules of animation. There's a wonderful paper with like 9 different little tips.
And what year?
In the 90s, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, little things like, I forget what it's called, but before a character runs, they step back once and then run to exaggerate the fact that they're about to run. Mm. That's an odd, because you usually just start running. But in animation, you step back once and then run. Stuff like
Have
that.
Have you seen a lot of those flicks, like Toy Story?
Oh, all those, Shrek? Yeah, they're all Lasseter, yeah.
And what do you make of them? I mean, as a designer, or even as a... As a guy who's now responsible for finding jobs for gifted graphic students, I mean, this looks like big...
Well, I think it's like a lot of work. I mean, most people aren't aware how much work it is to make those. Like, even like making like radio or audio, people aren't aware of what goes into making anything, especially when it's digital, especially when you can't see it, touch it, you know, taste it. You can't even like sort of feel what process made it. That's why I'm always jealous of like authors, just who people write books. Because when we grow up, we're taught that writing is hard. And, oh, you've made a book. It's fantastic. But when you make, like, a movie, they're like, that's really great. But you have no idea how it works.
I kept looking for sort of Maeda effects in Wall-E. Hmm. And there's a moment when there's a moment when they move themselves with these kind of fire extinguisher sprays of light. Mm, mm. And there's light sort of stars.
Yeah,
sort
I'm into of forming light
a
stars.
Wonderful cloud. And I thought, am I here to touch?
I'm into clouds. Yeah.
You do the clouds.
I like being foggy. Yeah.
But the other question is, how did you make that wonderful little graphic on the top of our page?
Oh, well, that was love. That was an effort of love. I was thinking, well, you know, how do we launch this whole Light and Maeda thing? And I was thinking, well, you know, I have my own icon. I kind of cut out of pixels. And I thought, let's make one for Chris. So I sat there for an hour kind of sculpting the icon. I had a great fun with that.
Did you do it dot by dot?
Dot by dot, yeah. Yeah.
One of my daughters said, you'll be showing up in The Simpsons any day now.
Yeah, that was fun. Well, I'm kind of hopeful that we'll think of, like, different ways to approach, you know, the web as a conversational space, not as you were saying before, not just sort of audio, but also visual, sort of a quasi the two together kind of thing.
Well, let's talk about it right now. You know, when you and I first spoke, practically the first words out of your mouth were, the question is how to make a global dialogue.
Yep.
And I think I said, you know, that's what, I'm thinking about that all the time.
Yeah.
But I think we have an opportunity between, you know, the screen of which you're the master and the audio side, which I've been in, doing for years and thought a lot about. Yep. It's really, and especially with this mobile platform, the iPhone and Blackberries and all of these things that people will now carry in their pockets, we can put it all in there. Robert Redford, I read, is going to make movies for the iPhone.
Oh, good for
him. Why can't we make some talk and images?
Yeah. Well, you know, we've always been talking about interactive media as coming someday. Someday there'll be interactive art. I mean, it already kind of exists, but isn't prevalent. And you know, your point about the iPhone is important because the iPhone is the first sort of very easy to use mobile platform that works generally all the time, not all the time, of course. And people don't think of it as a computer, but it is. It's a computer in our pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a different stage. In fact, to jump ahead, I wanted to ask you, I mean, we go from desktop to laptop, which works with all the imagery and the iconography of desks and documents and folders and trash baskets and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Now we come to the iPhone, which has a very different human feeling about it. It's much more like, how are you? How are you really? Yeah. Can I give you a hug?
Yeah.
Do I remember you? Mm. I like, you know, we're, it's a more eye contact friendly and emotional way of,
It's like having a child. I mean, versus having a TV. I mean, you can't carry your computer outside your house, whereas your iPhone you can carry somewhere with you. Also, it's just this relationship is different because you can hold it and you think it's minor. Anything that's small, we think, oh, it's no big deal. But actually, it's more sophisticated than our computers from 10 years ago. So, you'll figure.
And in the movie WALL-E, you can fall in love with it. I mean, the Eve from another planet has this terrific resemblance to an iPhone.
Oh,
and of course, WALL-E, the old trash compactor on the dead planet Earth, falls madly in love with her. And there's this wonderful, genius interaction, actually. Anyway, that's another.
But isn't the thing we're falling in love with is the story, not the characters? The fact that we can relate to that story we've seen in many, we've read, that we've seen, and we love those stories. Mm-hmm. We attach to them. And just because they've been computerized or digitized, we add another layer of, oh, this is a new way to see that wonderful story. I love to see this. When Harry Met Sally again, but now with the robots or the computers or water creatures, whatever. We love that because we love what is familiar and unfamiliar.
On the matter of the iconography of the iPhone, it's going to put people like you to work thinking up, instead of the trash can or instead of the folder, what are the signs going to be on this new device, this thing you put in your pocket, as you say? Don't we need a bit of a new language of that interaction?
Well, did you ever see Star Trek? Maybe I'm sure you saw
some time ago.
Star Trek, you know, some of the funnest episodes were when they went on the shuttle, the shuttlecraft, whatever.
Yes.
And the shuttlecraft is important because suddenly you aren't on this Hurricane, you know, aircraft carrier. You're now vulnerable on a tiny boat. And when you do that, when you make that step, you become vulnerable, more fragile. And the neat thing about something like a phone or a mobile device like the iPhone is, like, when you have your computer, you're on the battleship. And when you take your iPhone, you think you're now on a lifeboat. It's something kind of cozy. But because it's attached to the internet anyways, you still have the aircraft carrier in tow. You get both. You know? Full-fledged, all full military power, and it's cute and tiny. It's a wonderful feeling.
So what are the icons of that world? What are the new code images going to be?
Well, I mean, the sad thing is that every time we invent a new way to experience media, we always re-experience it. Like, for instance, when before the web, you know, we had computers that didn't have network, and so you had a floppy disk, which couldn't put much images on it, and then you had this thing called a CD-ROM drive. Fantastic media to hold bunches of images, so you can see all these images in high res. It was great. And then the web occurred, and suddenly everything was slow again. So you saw these tiny images no one could share, but then they got bigger and bigger, and you can see big images again. Same with mobile devices. We began with tiny images, low bandwidth. Now we have more bandwidth. And so the visual echo is always the same. I start off with less, and I get more, less and more. So I would argue that the real challenge is, how do you work with less? Because that's when it gets interesting. That's when the constraints exist. That's when you can't see it in full res. You know, it's like anything. Like a good example in fashion is, you know, why is it that the woman fully clothed is more attractive than a woman that isn't? It's because you can guess. Something that is abstract means it's something about something simpler, smaller, easy for your mind to make up the rest of the equation. When something becomes full res, you know, what's the point, kind of thing? I can read the entire Moby Dick on my iPhone, but because it's smaller, shouldn't I be doing it differently? you know, why don't I just read the iPhone, the Moby Dick poem instead? Because it's made for that size of device.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. There is a different level of intimacy, is what you're saying.
Intimacy, yes, yes. And so it may have to be treated differently.
Mm.
Yeah. And the problem with all media is that technologists go crazy. It's like, wow, you mean I can reinvent Linux on that phone? Oh, wait, I can actually do this too? And so they put everything they ever wanted into that device and they make it unlivable.
Mm. Yeah, I look forward to the kind of voice finding a new place on the iPhone.
Oh, yeah.
And voice tends to get drowned out on the laptop.
Yeah.
And the eye takes over.
Yep.
And, you know, praise God for YouTube. There's so much you can see and hear and experience on YouTube. But people don't listen.
Yep.
They don't get all the audio messages that they might, you know, when that's the prime experience. Yep.
It's because we don't have good technology for browsing audio. Visual has gone so well. Mm. We're good at multitasking this thing here. This listening thing is actually good at multitasking audio and video, but we haven't developed ways to work with stereo imaging of sounds. It's all been waiting for it to happen, but because you can't see it, it's hard for people to appreciate it. Think about how hard it is to sell a speaker in a magazine. This is a great speaker. You know, it looks fantastic.
Look
at
that wood.
These headphones are fantastic, whatever. You know. And so the market does not know how to market sound, I think. You know,
we're going to come to that. I want to talk about Tony Schwartz, and I want you to talk about Paul Rand. But this is the moment, I think, for the simple who you question. There are people listening to this who haven't the foggiest idea who I am, and a few who don't even know who you are.
Yeah, luckily.
Who is John Maeda?
Well, you know, John Maeda is a guy who doesn't really know how to say his last name, actually, himself. I grew up saying Maeda, but then I discovered later it was Maeda. But on the phone, I'll say Maeda because it's easier to spell that way. So I'm very democratic with my name. Secondly, you know, I've been very lucky because I was able to bridge many things in my career. You know, art, computer science.
You've barely begun, John.
Pardon me?
You're only 42, right? You're just well begun.
I'm going to be 42 this year, exactly, yeah. It's fun. Yeah, it's a fun time to be, and I'm grateful for everything. But it's all about how a guy who began as a technologist became an artist, and then became a manager or whatever. How did he move around? That's the thing I've been watching, you know, what is he doing kind of thing. Yeah. It all began from this Paul Rand person you mentioned. Paul Rand was someone that I saw in a book in my undergraduate years at MIT, where I was told I shouldn't do any art at all.
Hmm.
And I found this Rand book, and I thought, wow, this guy's tremendous. Wow, he's a great thinker. He's a great visual designer. What is this field, design? I chased after it, and 10 years later, I was in his studio in Connecticut, where I'd showed up from Japan, because I was living in Japan then, and I said, oh, you know, I'm here to see you. And he had a half an hour for me.
Hmm.
But he said to me, well, actually, my assistant didn't arrive yet today. He might be sick, so you'll have to work for me for free today. You know, and I said, okay. So I canceled everything, and I sat with him for the whole day, and I was, like, you know, doing stuff. He made me a sandwich, which is kind of funny. He made me a sandwich, you know, and a bologna sandwich. And then at the very end of the day, I was working on his last book for him, the final mechanical drawings of his book. And at the end of the day, he said, I'm not going to pay you anything, but you can put your name in my book, which is kind of interesting because like my whole career, my whole journey began with his book, and suddenly I'm typing my name into his book. That was very weird.
You but know. There for all time.
Yeah, I was like, wow, I'm kind of like, it's like connecting two dots that were on the opposite of sometimes, times, you know, sort of space. I'm like, oh, wow, look at that. What the heck is that? And then I invited him to speak at MIT, and we were going to be forever for life, but he passed away soon after. And so
this is the man who invented the IBM
logo. ABC, UPS.
That UPS
Next,
Tide
the
Box
Limited,
is still
IDO.
There.
Yeah, yes.
It's extraordinary. And I'm now in the spell of that book that moved you so.
Yeah.
But it lasts.
Oh, completely.
It's incredibly fresh. And it's so many book covers that I didn't know were his.
Yeah.
The Mink and Prejudices book, the Henry James on the American Essays book, all these.
Good. Yeah.
But a genius. So you now come to teach at a famous sort of school in arts across the board, from glassworks to architecture.
Yeah. Well, the neat thing about RISD is that it's very similar to MIT. There are geeks here as well. They're different kind of geeks. That's a fun part of it all. There's art and design geeks here. There were techno geeks over there, and they're very similar. They all love to make things. You know, you can't stop them. They're like some kind of alien race that loves to just sort of go make it. You know, what is it? What is it called? Like a fire ready aim kind of thing. So
the last survivors on a planet where almost everything that's made now is made in China.
Well, that's not true. The beauty of RISD and Providence, Rhode Island, is people still make stuff here. That's what we're finding. We're making audio here, too. And that's great. This isn't made in China either. Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing's wrong with China, of course. But I mean, the fact that people still want to make things well, that's what I think sits in this whole New England area. Mm-hmm. It's this idea that I can suffer through difficult times. I will make it because the church, whatever the time, wanted me to make it. I wanted to be pure. I'll do it. Mm-hmm. That gumption is here. Paul Rand, actually, I asked him when I was coming back from Japan to the States. I said, should I go to Los Angeles or UCLA or MIT? He said, oh, you got to go to the East Coast because if you live on the West Coast, your brain's going to melt. You know, in the East Coast, you've got snow. You've got suffering.
You got the Red Sox, who didn't win in those days.
There we go, back then, yeah. It's very Yoda-esque, basically. So I believe that kind of advice.
Yeah. Let me just say, for me, I mean, I come from from the much more the print side and the audio side, although you remind me, I mean, I took what was the famous Joseph Albers course at Yale.
Oh, yeah, you
basic
did that.
Design.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, well, he had just retired.
Yeah.
But it was a famous course known as Spots and Dots because you started with a cork and a dish of India ink.
Excellent.
And the mission was, okay, spots on white paper, see what happens. And that was like the first 6 weeks of the course you did spots and dots. But anyway, Neil Welliver taught the course in my year, became a famous painter, and I've always had that sort of that neglected side of me, but maybe we all do.
Now it's coming out, huh?
Yeah. I want to take some drawing classes.
This is where it's going to happen. There we go. I'm into that.
Whole new me.
Yeah.
But
it was always you.
I come from the journalistic side and definitely a reader and a writer, wannabe writer, but I'm in this conversation. I bring a fascination with the audio side, and I was thinking your Paul Rand, in a certain way, was a guy named Tony Schwartz in New York, roughly contemporary of Paul Rand, also deep into the commercial business, Coca-Cola commercials and a lot of political commercials. I mean, he did that whole thing. You may be too young, but it's the real thing.
Oh,
Coca-Cola.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he did a wonderful montage of Nixon in his Watergate speech saying, how could this have happened? Over, it's the real thing.
Good.
But he had the same kind of abstract understanding. Not abstract at all, really, but a kind of distilled understanding of what the ear is up to. The ear does not blink. The ear does not have lids.
Exactly.
And how it works anatomically, and especially how it works emotionally and even evolutionarily. He was a huge believer that the ear carries the main freight to your mind and to your heart. If you want to move somebody, just blindfold them and then whisper to them. In other words, in a commercial, he loved to make the video dull, slow it down, do a still if you want for 60 seconds, but say, I'm going to tell you about John Maeda. And people, you know, suddenly you have them.
Nice.
And you remember.
What a wonderful element.
He did a wonderful thing you could do with your own children. He did a kind of time sink biography of his niece from she was born till 13, and he put it in a 2.5 minute tape. It was just the sounds of her first cry, nursery rhymes, then as she melded together, 2.5 minutes you have her, the last line is something like, Grandpa, I'm getting interested in boys, or something like
funny.
That.
Funny.
But
yeah.
In any event.
It was playful then.
Playful, absolutely.
Where does playfulness come from in these sort of like mentors, masters? So why does it happen? Some are so serious that they can't play, but there are some who like to play. Where does that come from?
The child, or we associate with childhood, but of course it's not. It's very fundamental.
You can be 90 years old and still be playful, and you can still go there. Yeah, what is it? Is it something that you're taught is okay, or?
It's such a deep question. It's a hugely deep question because it's all about sex too. It's all about it's all about sex, candy, and play. You know,
interesting.
And that sense of ourselves. Right.
Who is the Albers of the sound world? You think? Just sound, not even like spoken words.
Who's the? Which is to say, the everybody the thinks spots of those and dots Albers of, squares. Well, it would have to be a musician, right?
Oh, there we go.
It would have to be... It might be Count Basie. It might be the minimalist of music. Listen to Count Basie's piano in that band. You know, he can hit one note.
Yeah.
And it swings.
It's neat. Because your voice is musical.
Wow.
It moves in like... It moves like this. I'll draw a picture. It moves like this and sharpens. So it has this sort of like weird sort of tonality to it. So because of the music, the message starts to get pushed in further. I can see that. Interesting.
That is interesting. You have a very musical voice and you go up and
down. Go high or low.
Yeah. But it's interesting. The only bit of flattery that I've ever really enjoyed is people who say... my best conversations are like jazz. It's like I take four bars, you take four bars.
Yeah, yeah. But the instrument that you have here tied to your mind is able to deliver that virtuosic sort of like, it just sort of like when someone says, sit here versus how you might say sit here. It's delivered in a way, and if you add the intellectual tonality to it, you get like it's amazing. I love that. Yeah, I'm learning. While listening.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's good.
I don't think I can teach you anything, John, but...
it's like a master class I'm getting. This is great. I love being at RISD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but the whole idea of voice and what it carries, Tony Schwartz was deep into this, that, it's more individual than a thumbprint, and it also registers... on the radio. I discovered this by doing it. I mean, I'm untheoretical and I haven't been taught anything, including voice or singing, although I do some. But I learned on talk radio that the voice is fantastically revealing. And then it must have been Tony who said, think about it evolutionarily. Think about, our forefathers on the plains of East Africa, how much you had to hear. You had to hear birds and signals and wind and friends and enemies and lovers and children and of course there was no print or no written or no much less any visual media, but the ear was completely refined.
Yeah.
But on talk radio, I discovered that people give you their excitement, they give you their mood, their anxiety, their depression, their affection, their all sorts of things freighted into. Studs Terkel, calls it Vox Humana, that fabulous instrument. So
that's fascinating because how they have that gross sort of picture of the homunculus, whatever the one, the picture of the different sensory parts of your body that are the most accentuated, like your lips are big and whatever. Have you ever seen this picture? It's like a weird picture.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm thinking how like the voice isn't part of that survival human being picture.
It is or isn't.
It isn't. It's just the lips are sensing, but it's never talking what's coming from inside. The whole argument of that creature is that creature is the most sensate version of yourself. And that's why human beings have been allowed to survive, because these sensory modes are active. But you're arguing that your voice had to project and protect yourself. And that voice is not represented in that figure. That gross figure of that person. It's interesting. It's nothing.
But how about the ears? I mean, surely...
The ears are... No, I don't know about the ear. The ear's high. The ear's high. I see what you're saying. But that it's different, though, I say. So I would ask, what's the opposite of the homunculus? The active parts of your... Versus just sensate. What are the active things that we've been doing to survive? Maybe our fist, our voice. Yeah.
Pose, thumb, and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder what this whole... So you have the voice, you have body language.
Yep.
I had this great discussion with a liberal arts professor today in his office. It was fantastic. It was a conversation about You know, I think that all good makers are made better by being better communicators and makers.
Mm.
And then, so this faculty person has said how, well, actually, different departments have different propensities for communication. I loved it. It was an aha moment.
Mm.
Like, painters maybe will maybe better versed at this kind of thinking, whereas a industrial designer is a wonderful vocalist, whatever. And so I was hearing this whole breakdown of this, and I was thinking how the same thing at MIT. Mm. Certain majors attract better communicators of a oral versus better or written, you know, or both.
Mm.
So that's fascinating. So I wonder, like, in different fields, this ability to communicate is kind of the, or is either important or not important. So when you're a communicator like yourself who can shift to any field, that's a cool thing. Because you're able to front end and back end the information. Yeah.
Interesting. You'll explain that to me. You'll draw a picture of it sometime.
This is sort of the being Christopher Lydon sort of movie.
You know, one of the things that was fascinating in the just the first exchange of emails or conversation you and I had, you raised this question about how to make a global dialogue. And of course, it's a technological question.
Sure.
But the internet is making it easier and easier and cheaper and cheaper and more universal. And that's going to, it's going to solve itself in a way. But then the question is, who do we want to talk to, and what do we want to talk about?
Yeah.
It reminds me of, you know, Thoreau, one of the great New Englanders, was not, he was not enamored of technology or progress or anything else. And when they while he was at Walden, they finished the railroad from Boston to Fitchburg. He didn't like it. He said, I can go to Fitchburg or Boston faster than I can go to either place and go to the other on the train.
Yeah.
But he also, when they completed the almost transcontinental telegraph from Maine to Texas, he said, the question is whether Maine has anything to say to Texas. And it's still sort of the question in media, like, what do we have to say to anybody, and and who who's out there? Of course, I think Emerson had the better of that argument. He was a globalist. He read Indian poetry. He knew the great British poets and writers. He was a one-world kind of guy, and he wanted to talk to everybody, and he made his living roaming the country giving lectures. But for us, in 2008, the question is, what works? What are people waiting to hear? What do they not know already in, in their village or their neighborhood?
Yeah, I know exactly what we have to do now. This is so exciting. What we have to do is, because I now know you're a spots and dots man, and now that we're sort of talking about tonality and information quality and content, I think we have to do something where we just make some visuals with audio attached to it and have people wonder what the heck were they trying to say. what current public interest is that depicting? Or could it be depicting? So imagine, because you also mentioned WALL-E, which is all just tonality.
Yes.
You know? And so, but it also has narrative. What if we were trying to remove narrative? We try to go abstract visually. We also go abstract in the auditory sense. You know, very few words at all. And play with sound and play with color and just open up the world and say, what the heck is this? What is being said here? And see what happens.
That's exciting. It really is exciting. We're suddenly in a sort of free jazz mode.
Yeah, it'd be neat. Like, you know, you can imagine like going from the checker pattern there to the beigeness over there to the voluptuous of that curve over there to the red, whatever, and then we add some sound to it, you know? Like I
is
love
this instrumental sound, human sound.
It's human, always human sound, because I love listening to sound backwards. I like to do it every day or something.
Yes.
But I love, because like what did they what is that?
Right.
I think I kind of understand.
It's Swedish.
Is that what it is?
English when you play the videotape backwards comes out Swedish.
Okay, there we go. So that kind of feeling of like I don't, and that way we can actually get very global. I think we can begin to sort of ask these questions of like these sounds, what are they? And maybe we can isolate the notes,
why do I have a memory, I don't want to hold you to it, but that you said, among other things, people love to talk about food, and they like to see food.
Oh, that's a good one, too. We could make this like a restaurant stop thing.
Yeah, riff on that. What does that mean?
Well, food, you know, have you been to El Forno?
Oh, sure.
Oh, El Forno. That's a RISD alum restaurant, by the way.
This is a little product insertion here.
It's very important. it really is my favorite restaurant now because it's sort of like it looks beautiful and it tastes great. You know, it's the two together.
And it's more filling.
And it's very expensive, of course, but it's very good. You know? But it's this whole notion of an ultimate experience rooted in the fact that we have to eat. You know, because we have to eat, it's part of our, I'm not sure if biology has some, so Latin, one of those Latin things means food, but we've got to eat, you know. And so, and it's something that is emotional in some cultures. Like my favorite example is there's, you know, that animator Hayao Miyazaki, the one who does like Princess Mononoke, or a very popular animator. Japanese, but very popular in the United States as well. One of his recent feature films, that's always about some young girl who's sort of lost somewhere and needs help in some kind of magical kingdom, whatever. And there's a scene during the movie where she's lost and people are kind of coming after some spirits, demons, whatever. And so then one spirit is helping her out and he lands in this field and he pulls out of his pocket bamboo leaves, which inside are holding a rice ball, basically a little compressed rice. And it's funny because in Japan, apparently 90% of Japanese people will cry when they see this. It's called the rice ball scene. I didn't cry when I saw it. You know, most people don't cry. But
it's because you were born in Seattle.
Thank you. Exactly. But what happens is because for Japanese people, that rice ball and feeling lost, and they get that food that they want. And it's like a very, it's like eating, it's like, piece, it's like opening up the thing and finding bread. Connecting to that rice ball to them means they're found as a culture. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure there are similar things in our food culture in Europe, in different countries, where people say like, ah, oh, that's so important to me. What is it to you? What's your favorite food?
Absolutely. No, I was just going to say, my wife was Armenian, and food is at the brink of religion.
There you go.
With Armenians.
Yeah.
It's beyond comfort food. I think it has to do with a lot of ancient history, but also modern history. It's consolation, it's family, it's connection. Lamb is at the center of it.
There we go.
All of my daughters are cooks. One of them is a famous chef, but lamb is the center of it. She, my middle daughter, famous chef, says, she would say, I'll never be able to cook lamb like that, the way my mommy did. And my wife used to say, I'll never be able to cook it the way my father did. It's this kind of...
There. That. What is that?
But it's that little curl of burnt fat on the edge of the chop or the leg of lamb. And it's marinades and it's cooking and whatnot. But then, no, it is... it is survival. It is connection. It is history. And, of course, the Armenians have been through hell in the 20th century. I mean, literally hell.
Yep.
And yet there is a grace and a richness. And and grace has something to do with it, too, I think.
It's story, isn't it? Story.
Yeah.
Religion, people, history.
Family.
Yeah. Huh. I mean... And also because we can't – I'm not sure – some smart scientists can tell us, I'm sure. But how well do we actually remember taste, I wonder? Or smell? I mean, similar. We can how if we were to compare how well we remember a sound or image or taste, I wonder if taste is something harder. Because our everyday we're using this a lot, our eyes and our ears. But this – we don't use as a kind of there isn't a college of maybe cooks probably a college of taste isn't natural education. Taste memory.
But can I was wondering? Did you mean people could even in our conversations that we want to draw people in to talk about food and images of food? Images of food are so powerful.
Yeah,
and our media is so full of them.
There we go.
Should we post some
food
pictures?
We should do food too. We should do food and current events. Back at, you know. A little bit of food, like current events, kind of like Donny and Marie back when it was a little rock and roll, a little bit country, whatever, you know. Yeah, mix it up.
So when you talk about that screen that has abstract images and sound, there should also be a recipe with it.
That too. This is a great excuse to go eating now. This is a great excuse to like dine around Providence, I think.
Amen. This is the place to go.
Restaurant review. Very abstract. So we reviewed your restaurant. We'd like to go. You go and see and hear this thing. You may not know that it's your food, but it really is. You know, and point your browser to this.
Do you think people want to talk about food? They want to look at it and eat it.
I don't know. That's a good one. I mean, well, the problem with food is it becomes kind of a fad, I think. So I think, you know, we want people, we should never want people to do whatever, but we would like to see people just sort of, I mean, I think that art to me, a lot of the goal today for my art or whatever I do with art, it's about appreciating being alive. Because that's probably all that matters to anyone, you know. We can talk about like global events and important things that are happening anywhere in the world. But at the end of the day, if you don't really enjoy today, then you're missing something. So art in food context, I think, would be about just sort of like, well, you know, you ate today. Isn't that great? Yeah, there was something good out there. You probably ate something good. You didn't notice it. Like a Subway sandwich, you know. Sometimes it's good. Or like a, what was that chain over there? Kosi. First Kosi I ever went to. Amazing. After that's been downhill since, you know, but that was a good first one. So those good moments are good, you know, anywhere you go.
I just want to toss it out that I think music, in my experience in talk radio, music is something that draws people out in a very powerful way.
Why?
Because it's people know it's an unbelievably powerful. I mean, it gives you goosebumps. It makes you cry. It makes you think of love and other wild emotions, and yet it's completely invisible, intangible, unidentifiable. And so it is in that sense a kind of symbol or token of all the things in our life that are overwhelmingly important but invisible and inward and mysterious. So it becomes, I might have said this to you before, I observed on call-in radio that when we did shows with composers, musicians, players, that was when people were talking about, in a way, religion one step removed. It's a way of talking about and thinking about the completely abstract things that move us and we know are central to us, but we can't quite define. And then it's beautiful.
That's neat. I mean, when you're saying about music, the first thing I thought of was like music and education. How they're both very abstract. You can't touch and feel them. Like today, you know, the person who maintains this floor, she's like a Portuguese woman. And she said, my granddaughter doesn't want to go to college. And so she was kind of perplexed because she's an immigrant and third generation child. You know, I mean, she wants to go to college, but she just refuses to go to college. So let me talk with her. So this morning, actually, she was here. She also helps with the cleaning of this floor. And I said, oh, hi, you know, let's talk about this. And I want to say something to her. That was that, well, she's in an era where what is college is a question. You know, what is it for? Will it guarantee you success? I mean, there was this great article in the Boston Globe about how there was a person in high school where the teacher said in the high school class, if you don't go to college, you're nothing. And his dad was a truck driving company owner and got very upset.
Amen. Good for him.
Yeah, made a website that said, you know, whatever, kind of bluecollarparents.com, whatever. And so what I explained to her is that if you don't go to college, your life will be okay as long as you do rule number one, which is work hard, which you learn somewhere else, not in school definitely, but you learn from your parents or some kind of event happens. Rule number two is as you get older, you seek insurance in your life. Some kind of insurance. In that sense, education is a great insurance, but not a guarantee to anything, you know. But because it's so intangible, even life insurance, why do we buy it? We can't touch it, whatever. And so music, again, intangible. I find these intangibles fascinating right now.
You know, that eternal hit on the BBC, Desert Island Discs, basically just asks famous
what is that?
People. It's a show that asks people to come in and play and talk about the 5 or 10 recordings that they would take to a desert island.
Oh, there
they
we
weren't
go.
Coming back.
Nice. You know, oh, that's great.
This recording of Beethoven or that recording of Art Tatum or whatever.
Yeah.
And I've done that actually in a number of parts of the world, including Singapore, including Ghana, including Jamaica. And it's just a completely automatic entrance into people's most important part of their lives. You say, John Maeda, what are the five records you're taking to outer space? You're not coming back. You'd tell me a lot about yourself. Because, you know.
I've stopped listening to music, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is this to punish yourself? Or
maybe a little bit. Maybe I'm a puritanical New England.
You're fasting?
I don't know. I'm just, I just don't want to listen to music. It's just sort of strange, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I just don't want it to come into my head for some reason. Yeah.
And good music, bad music?
Any kind of music, yeah.
Car music?
I used to like music, yeah. I have like five iPods. I don't use them.
I have one that I don't use enough because I don't really believe in having stuff in your ears all the time at that level of intimacy and focus and concentration. Yeah. But I couldn't live without music. I mean,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. Did you give it up?
I found that by not listening to music, I can just sort of like I can float around in my thoughts much in a different way.
Hmm.
I think music helps it to flow, but I find that now my brain is moving in so many like dimensions with this new, you know, job as president. So I'm kind of like, I realize that I have to make 90 degree turns often. And to do so, I have to go off road a bit. So music might be a way to kind of stay on the road and kind of, you know, not even just happy music, sort of be connected. I think I'm so disconnected right now, I can't afford to be stuck in something.
Wow. That, so it's sort of ridding your mind of temptation and distraction.
There we go. Could be unhealthy.
John, we're gonna see how long this lasts. If it lasts 5 years, we're gonna
have to pull me out or something.
Do you like live music? Do you like to go when that's the subject?
Well, no. It's more like this. It's this question of like, you know, to like something means you're liking something that exists. I think that I'm finding a fascination with liking something that doesn't exist, and to do so, we have to be off the deserted island, I think. And so what I enjoy about this conversation is I think we're looking for something that hasn't been done before.
Good.
We have no commercial constraints. We're just trying it out.
Amen.
You know,
good.
I just put my credit card down to get that site, so we're all set. we have 2 years worth.
I think
there.
I owe you $10 or $20.
We'll take care of it later. But I did that so that we're all set. So now we have an island to think about stuff.
Yeah.
And no one has to come to it. It doesn't matter.
John, I love every second of it. It's really, really fun.
You know?
The music question is deep, and I got to ponder that. But can I ask you just one big question? You know, everybody around Providence and New England really is so fascinated with your opportunity here, and it's a great move for Rhode Island and for business and for RISD and for Brown. Mm. The one thing I haven't heard from you about you, John, is the Maeda aesthetic, the beauty quotient in the Maeda ambition for RISD and where it wants to go artistically. At the end of the day, it is about art, even more than it's about commerce. And I just wonder who are the great geniuses of the Maeda imagination? Who'd you grow up with? Where does the artist in you want to go?
Oh, well, you know, what was it? They did a survey of the top artists of the world, or the one everyone admires. I think last year Duchamp began to be number one.
Really?
Yeah. I love Duchamp, because Duchamp to me was never about aesthetics. It was about a cultural aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
Something wasn't how you look at it. It's more about how you look. And it isn't how you look at something, but how that whole how you look at something, the meta question, I think is what he was able to look at. And so for me right now, I'm asking the question, how do you look at what an art and design school is about today?
Mm.
That question, not how it looks or what it looks, but what it makes, so you will look at. It's how do you look at that question? It's the question I'm looking at as my medium right now, as an artist.
Looking.
Yeah. How do you look at the question itself?
Hmm.
You know, to ask the question, what is an art and design school today? That question I find interesting.
Hmm.
Yeah. I have no clear answer for that. I just have very simple data points that excite me. I addressed a pre-college audience at this program I have at RISD. And you know, people ask me, what is my strategic plan? And you know, I'm just brand new, so I don't really have that yet. And so I have some ideas about ideas, and so I told the pre-college people, I need help. Can you help me out? I've got a few ideas, and I'll ask you to applaud for the ones you think are good, and you know, I can razz the ones that are bad, whatever. And so I threw them out. And I threw like lifelong learning scenarios for art and design, whatever. That was kind of like this. It was okay. And another one I thought they would like, which was become the next Matisse Duchamp of this center of century. It was better, but sort of not whatever. Other one was like a global citizenship, you know, being a part of the world. That was much better, but nothing. But the one that actually like got them excited, which I didn't expect at all, was to build a case for creativity, to build a justification for creativity in the century. And they went crazy. I felt like Bono. There were these kids with like, you know, mohawks and like ear piercings and like nose piercings and whatever. And I was like, whoa, you want to go after the core intellectual question that has plagued centuries of like, you know, question marks around why do you bother to be an artist or creative person or, you know, stop messing with this audio thing you're doing, go like become a lawyer, you know. They all were revolting against that. And they wanted RISD or any art and design sculpture to solve that in this century. And later on, I was outside, and I came up to, and one of these pre-college kids came up to me and said, well, I want to know why you resonated with that. And she said to me, it's because where I'm at in my high school, no one cares about what I do. And I'm here, and I think maybe the world will start caring about it. It's neat.
Wow. What's the version in their heads, do you think, of what you were saying?
Yeah. Now, I think what they were saying was, wow, this guy's a president, actually cares what we actually care about. And we're gonna let him know that to go and do it. Another life-changing moment tied to that was I was watching a YouTube video by accident because, you know, you have an iPhone, your kid plays the iPhone, all kind of YouTube stuff comes up. Not bad stuff, but some good stuff. And there's one YouTube video where a guy is trying to get more voters recruited online. And that's interesting in itself. But then he says something to his deadpan audience. He says, you know, and if you're underage, you can't vote, but you still matter. You actually matter now more than ever because you have a voice on the internet. And I was like, wow, isn't that deep? So to me, the pre-college kids were saying to me, we're not pre-college kids. We are citizens of this world. We're telling you, the present, to go do this. I thought it was cool.
Wow, that is deep. That is maybe that's our cue to go home and humble ourselves and come back and do this again.
Yeah. Well, I let's go after this whole visual. You know, I can imagine something with like Christopher Lydon sort of blooping, sort of pre-vocal or whatever. And I'll throw in some images, and we'll get people to talk about them. Yeah,
let's do it.
Okay,
let's do it.
All right.
John Mayday, this is a huge pleasure, and we'll gather again at the right moment and give them chapter two.
Let's put snippets up and get it going.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Very fun.